That there were a few left. The Book of Kings records that there were a few left, but they were just of the poorest sort. Now, it's quite possible that if some of us were in Jerusalem at the time of this great onslaught and captivity, we might have been the ones left. The poorest sort were left. However, we probably would not be among those left. We're probably not as poor as we think we are. And we're going to, before this chapter is over, we're going to get into more discussion of these few that were left. Verse 7, the new wine mourneth, the vine languisheth, all merry-hearted do sigh. Now this is just further descriptions of what is left here after this great devastation by the Babylonian onslaught. This word for new wine here is tirosh, and it means grape juice, or the must, or the just squeezed out juice of the grape. This is according to Mr. Barnes and his commentary. And when he says the new wine mourneth, what he probably is meaning here is that there's nobody left to drink it. Nobody left to consume it or to use it as it is supposed to be used. And so it's mourning. The vine languisheth. That is, the vine grows feeble and weak because there's no one to cultivate and to harvest the product of the vine. And all the merry-hearted do sigh. There's no more being merry. You can't be merry-hearted and sigh at the same time. If you're sighing, then you're no longer merry-hearted. And so that's what he's saying is there's no more merriness left in them. The mirth of Tabret ceaseth. The noise of them that rejoice endeth. The joy of the harp ceaseth. Now, Tabret was a thing kind of like we'd call a tambourine today, kind of like maybe a kettle drum. Could be big or small, and you would bang on it and make a noise. He said, the mirth that comes with the use of those things will end. The noise of them that rejoice endeth. There'd be no more rejoicing. And the joy of the harp ceaseth. That is, be no more playing of the harp. All of the music, all of the finer cultivated things of life would just be out. There'd be no more joy there at all. They shall not drink wine with a song. Now the word wine here is fermented wine, shemer. They shall not drink, or rather yayin. They shall not drink wine with a song. And it would, of course, have been customary to drink wine and to make merry. You'd sing a song as you drank the wine. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. And this phrase, strong drink, is not wine, but it's a stronger drink in alcohol content than wine was. Yet they both contain the same element that would cause intoxication, which is alcohol. Regardless of what you drink that's intoxicating, it all has the same thing. Whether it's wine or whether it's gin or rum or beer or whiskey or whatever, it all has that one element in it that makes you intoxicated, which is alcohol. The city of confusion is broken down. Now this word here for confusion is the same word used in Genesis 1 and 2, in which in speaking of creating the world, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void. Well, that word therefore, without form, is the same word here that's confusion. And the city of confusion, that is, when God created the world, he didn't create it in a state of confusion or without form, because he created nothing in confusion, but it became into a state of confusion. And so here it is, the same with this city. It's a city that became in a state of confusion, and he's saying this anticipating the attack by Babylon. It is broken down. The city of confusion is broken down. That is, the walls would be broken down. The houses would be broken down. Their defenses would no longer be adequate. Every house is shut up, that no man may come in. This would just depict maybe street fighting or invasion by an army. There is crying for wine in the streets. Now this crying for wine in the streets is probably persons who are in a state of pain or agony or distress or some kind, and they're crying for wine to relieve them of their distress, maybe through drunkenness, maybe through the medicinal effect that it might have. All joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. Now, if you could just be there in that city and note the things that he's speaking of here, you would see desolation, you'd see destruction, you'd see a gate that had been smitten down with destruction, that is, it no longer would hold up and keep anybody out. You just walk through the gate, it's torn down. The defenses are no longer there. All joy is darkened. The mirth is gone. You don't hear anybody laugh or anybody make any kind of remark that would be taken in a light manner at all. The city is left desolation, or in the city is left desolation. Now, beginning in verse 13, he begins to give us a picture of the fact that there would be a few people left, though, in the city. When thus it shall be in the midst of the land among the people, there shall be as the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. Now, it would be just like if you went and harvested the olives, and you shook the tree, you'd get most of the olives, but there'd be a few, maybe some on the uppermost or outermost branches that you wouldn't get. You could say, oh yeah, we shook the olives out and we gathered the olives, but there might be a few left in the tree, maybe a few that you didn't see. And the same is true with the gleaning of grapes when the vintage is done. There'd still be some grapes that you didn't get. And this is true of most crops, you know, that's harvested. Whenever I was a kid, we tried to make a living raising cotton. And you'd pick the cotton and go back and pull bows and all this, but still there'd be a little straggling amount of cotton left out there. And when it got so that there wasn't enough to pay you to go out and get it, you left it. And that's the way it was with this city of Jerusalem. There's a few left. Maybe people just overlooked. Maybe people who hid out in the caves or whatever, but there was a few people that were left. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing for the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the sea. Now those who were left would continue then to serve God. They would do it the best that they could. They'd lift up their voice to God. They'd sing for the majesty of the Lord. And they would cry aloud from the sea. Now this crying from the sea, and it ties in with the next verse, could be those that had fled to the outer reaches around Jerusalem. Maybe they had hidden out along the coast. Maybe they had hidden out on some of the islands as they cried from the sea. But nevertheless, they had escaped the captivity. That's what he's saying here. Wherefore glorify ye the Lord in the fires, even the name of the Lord God of Israel, in the isles of the sea. Now there's a lot of confusion among the commentators as to what it means here by glorify the Lord in the fires. The word here for fires means some kind of a light, and it could mean, some have even conjectured that it could mean the northern lights at night. They could glorify God under those lights, or it could mean as the sun rises, or it could mean as fires that actually were built, or it could just mean in the light of knowledge and truth. Or there's another group that translate this word, the fires, as the valleys. And they probably don't have, according to some, a valid reason for saying it, but glorify ye the Lord in the valleys. That is, you've hidden out in the caves and in the recesses, and now that's where you're going to glorify God from a hidden position. Even the name of the Lord of God of Israel in the isles of the sea. And this in the isles of the sea would be, again, those that had scattered out into the area of the isles of the sea to escape the captivity. Now in the 16th verse, he's still speaking those remnant, those few that were left. And now Isaiah puts himself in the shoes of one of them. It's as though he were one of them now, and this is what he sees as he remains behind after the desolation, after the captivity, as he remains behind. This is what comes to him through his miraculous inspiration. From the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs. Now, this is a picture of Jews scattered everywhere. The Jewish people, not just in captivity in Babylon, but from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs. And of course, as we know, and as has been proven over and over again, the Jewish nation was scattered to the four corners of the earth. They have evidence of the Jewish culture in China, in Japan, in Ethiopia, in Africa, even among the American Indians. Every place, Jewish culture has left its mark. So from the uttermost part of the earth have we heard songs. It's as though Isaiah were there in Jerusalem, and he could hear with the mind of the Spirit and with the miraculous ability that he would have as a prophet, he could hear the Jews, the people of God, praising God all over the earth. Now, not going on here right in Jerusalem itself so much, but coming from other parts of the earth. And the songs would say such things, even glory to the righteous. This is the content of the songs. Glory to the righteous. That is, they were giving still honor to God's people, still recognizing them as being the people of God, and still looking forward with the eye of faith to the time in which these righteous would come forth from the captivity and again be the children of God and be allowed to serve God. Now, as Isaiah hears this, "But I said," now this is Isaiah's reply to this, "But I said, my leanness, woe unto me. The treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously." All Isaiah could see, all he could think of to say in response to this praise that was being sung around the world, all he could say was, my leanness. Now, the term leanness, which is the opposite of being fat, the idea of losing flesh from the body is always a sign of something bad going wrong. Either you're being starved to death for not having enough to eat, or you're in a state of sickness, you're unable to eat, you're in a state of deprivation some way. And so as Isaiah looks around and as he hears this, he says, my leanness, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. All these people had to look forward to in Jerusalem was this state of fear. Now, I believe in the 17th verse, we shift back from that picture of Isaiah hearing the praise of God around the world, and we shift back now to further descriptions of the judgments upon the land before they were carried away. And this one that he calls here, O inhabitant of the earth, which would be the citizen of Jerusalem, what did he have to look forward to? Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee. And it's a picture here of the sequence of trapping an animal. The first thing they would do would be to bring about some kind of a noise or some kind of a sign that would incite fear in the animal. And then as the animal would try to run from that source of fear, he would fall into a pit that had been laid for him. A deep hole dug in the ground, maybe covered over with some limbs so that he couldn't tell it was there, and he'd fall into it. And then if the pit didn't get him, a snare would get him. A trap would get him, like catching a bird of some kind. And we're going to see how it's further described. If he falls into the pit and gets out of it, then the snare may get him. And so what he's talking about here is a sequence of calamities. As you run from one, you get into one that's even worse. And we have this very same picture given in the book of Amos. I want to read a couple of verses here in Amos. Amos 5, verses 18 and 19. And Amos is talking about the captivity now of the northern nation, Israel, whereas Isaiah is talking about Judah. But he's in Amos, he says, "Woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord! To what end is it for you? The day of the Lord is darkness and not light." Now these people were saying, "Well, I'd be glad to see the Lord come. I want to have the end of the world come. I'd like to see the day of the Lord come." Well, he says, "Woe unto you that desire the day of the Lord. You know what you're talking about. Why, it's going to be an end to you. It's going to be darkness. It's not going to be light when the day of the Lord comes. As if a man did flee from a lion and a bear met him. Or he went into the house and leaned his house upon the wall and a serpent bit him." Why, he's running from a lion, and as he runs from that lion, he runs into a bear. He sure hadn't helped himself any, even though he got away from the lion. The bears got him now. Or he escaped and he got into the house, and just as he thought he was in a place of safety, and he leaned his hand up on the wall, a serpent bit him. And the houses of that day did have serpents that would live in the walls of the house. And it was a danger. And even in that part of the country today, they have in Egypt or India, they have a thing called a mongoose that they put in their house to kill the serpents out of the walls. And so it's just a matter of, you know, you run from one danger and you fall into another one even worse. If I knew there was a snake in my house, I'd be staying out of it, even if there was something out there trying to get me, because I'd be afraid to go in there where the snake was. And that's what he's describing here. Well, he says, fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit. And he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. There's just not going to be any escape for you. If you get away from one, you've got another one there, just as bad or worse than it is, ready to trap you. Fear and the pit and the snare. That's what you have to look forward to. And of course, an animal who is made afraid and he runs, he's unaware of the fact that he's running into a danger worse than the noise that he's running from. Then he says, after the word snare in verse 18, for the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. Now the windows from on high, this is no doubt a description taken from Genesis 7 and 9, in which he's talking 7 and 11, in which he's talking about the flood coming. Whenever the flood came, that description of it there says that the windows opened, the lattices opened, and let the waters come. And it's the same word here used for windows. The windows from on high are open. And it simply means that now the gates are open and this vast destruction is free to flow through on you just as though it was coming from heaven itself. And the foundation of the earth do shake. That, of course, would be similar to the description of an earthquake. Verse 19. The earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. The earth is moved exceedingly. This description that Isaiah gives here is of this thing being completely, totally demolished. It's utterly broken down. It is clean dissolved. It is moved exceedingly. Now he's describing how it looks really after the final destruction of the city has occurred. And as we think of and as we look at this destruction of Jerusalem, we see that it also is a type of the fall of the church. Now, just as they were carried away into captivity by Babylon, which was a false religion, a power that overwhelmed them, even so there came a time during the history of the church in which the church was also carried away into captivity by a false religion. It's described for us in the book of Revelation. This false religion, of course, was the power derived from the Pope that is contrary to all that's taught in the Bible about the church. And so the church could have been described in this way also, as something that is utterly broken down, that is clean dissolved, that is moved exceedingly. And as you would look around and go back and visit the land of Jerusalem, just as you would look for the true church during that time, there'd just be a very, very few there. And you couldn't really find the true worship of God being carried on. The temple destroyed. The sanctuary no longer exists. The priesthood not even functioning. That's the way it was. And what a sad time that was for the church when it could be said about the church that it is utterly broken down, that the earth is clean dissolved, and the earth is moved exceedingly. Now, of course, as we study the religions of the world, we don't find that they're going to describe Judaism as having come to a halt or no longer existing in its true phase, but it did. It did come to a halt, and it didn't exist as it truly should have. And as we study the secular history given of Christianity, they do not describe Christianity as coming to a halt and ceasing to exist either. But so far as secular history goes, There is no evidence or record of the true church during this time of its captivity by spiritual Babylon. And this great popish power which did overwhelm the church is described in the book of Revelation as Babylon. And its destruction is described as the destruction of Babylon. He further describes it in verse 20. The earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard, and shall be removed like a cottage. Now, to think of a drunkard reeling to and fro, unable to stand, unsteady on his feet. He may fall and get up, and he may fall and get up. But ultimately, he's going to fall and not get up. He says that he shall be removed like a cottage. And this word here for cottage really means not a cottage as we would think of a building, but a temporary hanging bed like a hammock that would be hung maybe in a field or in a vineyard so that the person who was watching could climb up in it and be safe from animals and predators, but yet he could watch and guard over it. And it would move in the wind. It could be shaken and rocked back and forth. He said it'd be removed like a cottage or like a hanging bed. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. Finally, there's going to come a time whenever this reeling and staggering drunkard is going to fall, and he's going to lay. He's not going to be able to get up anymore, because his transgressions are, his imbibing of drink, are so increasing upon him until he's no longer able to tolerate or to function in that condition. In Israel's case, it was the transgressions thereof shall be heavy upon it. Their disobedience of God's will are so heavy, are so great, until they no longer can function. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. Now the host of the high ones that are upon high, this is probably those who were in the ecclesiastical area, that is the priests, those who were dealing with the spiritual aspect of the nation, and the kings of the earth that are on the earth would be then the literal civil rulers also. I'm going to punish both groups. The priests and the civil rulers in that day. And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit. And the word here for pit is also the same as dungeon. And shall be shut up in the prison. And after many days shall they be visited. So this is speaking of their captivity. They're going to be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit or in the dungeon. They're going to be shut up in the prison. That is, Babylon was their prison. They were in a prison or in a state of being a prisoner all this time. And after many days shall they be visited. Now the many days, of course, would have to be the 70-year period. They were in Babylon for 70 years. And after this many days, or after this 70-year period, they'll be visited. And the word here for visited can be a favorable term or an unfavorable term. It can mean that God is going to bring a wrath upon them, or it can mean that God is going to bring some benefit upon them. And it can mean very properly that they will be reviewed, numbered, and aided. And of course, there was a time at the end of the 70 years in which his people were reviewed, they were numbered, and they were aided by God, and they were allowed to go back to Jerusalem. Then, that is, after they were visited, after they were freed from this captivity, then the moon shall be confounded, and the sun ashamed, when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, before his ancients, gloriously. Now, the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed. What this simply means is that at that time when God does reestablish righteousness as it should be in Jerusalem, then the powers round about that would be depicted figuratively and prophetically as the moon and the sun, and God does in many places regard the ruling powers as moons and suns and stars, they're going to be ashamed, they're going to be confounded, they're going to be dimmed so that they'll have no luster really like they formerly had whenever God's people are really following what he wants and he sets up his reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem before his ancients gloriously. Now this of course is talking about their return to Jerusalem. It's talking about the time in which they did prosper as a part of God's reigning people. And the worship was reestablished, the temple was rebuilt, and the priesthood was functioning. But it is also a prophecy and the fuller extent pertaining to the reign of the Messiah. When he says, when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem before his ancients gloriously. This Lord of hosts here, of course, equally applies to the Messiah. Now, whenever the time comes that he's going to set up the kingdom and he's going to reign in Mount Zion, then that government will make all the other governments pale in significance. It'll make them confounded. It'll make them ashamed because they'll not be able to destroy or to overcome or to do away with that kingdom that he will establish. Well, Isaiah 2:44 says, in the days of those kings, speaking of the Roman Empire, in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. He's talking about the church. That time has come. The kingdom has been established. The church has been established, according to Acts, the second chapter. And it is a kingdom. It does have a ruling power. It does have a governing authority that no kingdom on the earth has ever been able to diminish or overcome. It has outlasted all the other kingdoms. While the Roman Empire has gone under and no longer exists, the kingdom of heaven is still highly existing, a very potent and vital power, and it does still exist. And he's going to rule there in Jerusalem and in Mount Zion, which is a figurative term now, speaking of the Messiah, which does exist in every nation under heaven today, and before his ancients gloriously. His ancients are those that are keeping the law, those that have been schooled in his ways and in his law, and he's going to rule there gloriously. And the key to this whole verse is that word gloriously. For then shall his subjects obey his rule. They're going to obey the law. They're no longer going to be in a condition of flouting what the Lord wants them to do, but they're going to be keeping his law. They'll not be said to be transgressing his law or changing his statutes. Whenever they see a statute, they're going to keep it. They're going to know what it is, and they're going to know why it is, and they're going to do what it says and not change it, nor are they going to violate it. And then, which is the time of the church even today, during that time, can he rule gloriously. If his subjects aren't following what he says, if they aren't obeying his rule, then they're not. He's not ruling gloriously. It's impossible. During the time of the destruction by Babylon, it was impossible for the Lord to rule gloriously then because the people weren't obeying him. And so only with obedient subjects, only those who are obeying his law, only then can he rule in a state that can be said to be gloriously. And so it comes right down to us today. We then who have access to his word and to his law and his will, we have a choice to make. Are we going to obey it to the extent that he can be said to be ruling gloriously? Or are we going to flout it, to disobey it, to change it, to ignore it, so that he has no way that he can rule gloriously? Certainly he won't be ruling gloriously in us. Are we going to put ourselves in that position of destruction, in that position where we're going to be fit for destruction and not fit to be his servants? We have a choice to make. And the choice revolves around whether or not we're going to obey his rule. Now, if he was strict on them for their being slack, we can't go back there and say, well, look what these people did. They got away with a lot of things. They didn't get away with anything. And we today also cannot count on being able to get away with anything when it comes to violating God's law. We're duty-bound and obligated to know what it says. And we're duty-bound and obligated to obey it once we know what it says. We can't go around in ignorance. Can't shrug your shoulder and say, well, I don't care, it doesn't make any difference. If somebody else worry about that, it is our business. Our business today. So that he then can rule before his ancients gloriously and not bring shame and disgrace upon him. Well, we're going to close there. Next time, Lord willing, we'll begin with the 25th chapter. We would like to close with a word of prayer, and we'd like to ask Brother Lewis Cother, if you would, to direct us in a word of prayer.
Upon these words and take them into our everyday lives and lay them before our fellow men. God to forgive us for any sins that we might have, since we ask to cross thy son of grace. But ask our blessed blessings upon each soul represented here tonight. Now, dear Father, go with us.